Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. Philip in for Joe again. How are you this afternoon? Here is one that I'm almost certain you would not have had in your game of pandemic bingo. Unforeseen consequences of the COVID. An increase in the feral cat population of the island. And in the box next to it in your bingo card, rogue cat catchers making a killing out of pretending to solve the problem. Cyriline Power, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. Lovely to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you too. Why is it that there has been an increase in feral cats specifically during the lockdown?
Well, basically the cats didn't observe social distancing and so the kittens kept arriving. And I don't think that people realise just how prolific cats can be. A female kitten can have her first litter when she's only about 5 months old, and then she can continue breeding from there on. So the kittens that keep arriving, and then people don't neuter and spay, and so the problem gets out of hand.
So one cat could, by the end of the year, foreseeably have given rise to another maybe 15 or more cats and so on.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we sometimes, in Cats Aid, we sometimes get people contacting us and they are actually dealing with three generations of cats. So the problem should have been addressed with the first generation. Because groups can help if you have one or two stray cats in your garden. But when it's 10, 20 cats, it's far more difficult.
And where there is a problem, there is always somebody looking to make a fast buck. So tell me about these rogue cat catchers.
Well, we haven't had any direct experience of this, but we have seen items online and people posting on Facebook and that, and neighbourhood communities warning that cats have been disappearing around their area, or that cats have been poisoned. And obviously putting down poison is illegal, but people still do it. Sometimes these would-be groups who are rounding up the cats, or they might be just local residents who are simply fed up with the cat population.
But there are those that we have heard about travelling around in white vans, offering to neuter the cats, Maria, but taking them away and just relocating them to the Dublin Hills.
Oh, yes, indeed. Or sometimes they might not even relocate them. They might kill them. Just I won't call it putting them to sleep, because their methods are not always very humane. We have heard stories of these vans and cats being gassed.
Good Lord, really?
Mm. Part of the problem is that cats don't have protection under the law. So basically, you can kind of do whatever you like with cats.
Oh, but they must have. Do they not have protection from cruel treatment?
Dogs do, but cats not so much. Cats are still basically regarded as feral. And it's extremely difficult to get a conviction for cruelty.
Really? Even if you were to do something absolutely unhumanly cruel to a cat, you're saying that it's much, much less likely to be prosecuted than if you had done the same thing to a dog?
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's go back to the feral cat problem, though, Cyriline, because, all right, the last thing that they need to be done is gassed in the back of a white van, or thrown out of the back of the white van as it travels at speed through the Sally Gap or wherever it is. But there is an issue here with having to get the feral cat population under control. How would you deal with it?
Well, all the rescue groups will all say the same thing. The way forward is trap, neuter, return. And that means going to a colony, humanely trapping the cats, bringing them to a vet, getting them neutered or spayed, and whatever vet treatment might be necessary. and then if they are healthy, returning them to their location.
And why not just trap and euthanize?
Well, if you cull a complete colony, you get what's called the vacuum effect, and other cats will simply move in and take over. So the ideal situation is to have a small, stable colony that have been neutered and spayed and that are healthy, and then have a few people keeping an eye on them, putting some food out for them. And the cats serve the purpose of rodent control.
Okay.
And they will stop other cats moving in.
But when those neutered cats do eventually shuffle off this mortal coil, does the same thing not happen? Does that space not end up being filled by other feral cats anyway? And all you have done is sustain the population of the feral cat in the area for a few more years?
Well, that's true, but up to a point, yes. Yes, mm-hmm.
But still, you, excuse me, in Cat's Aid would say, no, a cull is not the answer here.
No, definitely not, no.
Well, who's making the arguments for the birds here, though, Cyrilline? Because I did a brief bit of research on this, and I can't stand over these numbers. But it was suggested not that long ago that the cat population, both domestic and feral in Ireland, is 700,000 cats. And looking at a test that was done in a university in the United States where they put little kitty cat monitors on them to see how many birds they would kill in a night, that basically, long story short, you apply this study to Ireland, the cats are killing up to 4 million birds a year, and some of these are endangered species.
Right, well, that's a huge number, certainly, absolutely. But generally speaking, if people have cats and if there are birds around the area, we would suggest keeping the cats in, say, at the time that the birds feed in the morning, and then again at the time that the birds come home to roost at night. And very often, I think the birds that the cats catch would be fledglings, maybe, or birds that have been hurt or injured, and birds which probably wouldn't survive.
Marion Fitzgibbon.
I do see where people are coming from.
Yeah. Marion Fitzgibbon, good afternoon. How are you?
Well, good afternoon.
You say that feral cats carry a risk in terms of disease.
Well, all animals, as we know to our, as I say recently, and all animals carry disease, you know, but cats that are out in the wild like that, I mean, if you have a domestic cat, you have it vaccinated, you have it worm dosed, you have it neutered, and if it's sick, it goes to the vet. But I mean, unfortunately, poor feral cats, they just have to do their best to survive. So you will see colonies of feral cats where disease will come in, and all of a sudden you notice the cats are disappearing. And, if a colony gets overpopulated, maybe like what's happening with the human population at the moment, some virus or something comes along and decimates about 2/3 of them and only leaves a third. And that can happen in colonies of cats, especially colonies that, as the ideal is somebody's going in, somebody's watching the colony, somebody is trapping and neutering and releasing, somebody's looking, if sees a sick cat in the colony, they'll trap it and take it away. But we have, as you say, if we do have 700,000 cats out there at the moment, it's impossible really to keep all these healthy and well. And I mean,
Is that an argument then, Marion, for reducing the overall population of cats?
Well, it's an argument for, first of all, having legislation. We have a dog control bill. We have dog control units all over Ireland. The county councils take some responsibility. In different counties, the service is better. But there is a dog pound, usually, or they call them, I think.
But we leave the cats to their own devices.
We have horse control. We have legislation written down. No one has ever put one bit of legislation on paper about a cat. So cats are supposed to live out there, I don't know, on mice or maybe birds or whatever. But they're just ignored in the Irish countryside, largely.
And Marion, you say that at the start of the pandemic that there were people who were poisoning cats.
Yes. Well, they poison, people poison cats all the time because they don't want them in their flower pots and in their gardens and wherever. And if nobody can come and help, I mean, all the charities and all the sanctuaries and all the people around the country that are trying to come to grips with cat welfare, you can't possibly respond to every cat call you get every day because...
No, of course you can't, but why were people poisoning them at the pandemic, at the start of the pandemic in particular?
Well, it was a kind of a scare out that because coronavirus was the virus that the people had, were suffering from a form of coronavirus, that they thought, well, you know, kittens do get coronavirus, but kittens, there is no transmission that we know of them in. It's feline, it's not a cat. It's not something that transmits.
So in the early stages when we knew even less than we know now,
Years ago, people were afraid that they were getting AIDS from cats and they were all poisoning cats then. So it was just the mention of coronavirus, I think people thought that the cats could bring in coronavirus into the household or whatever. So we did have reports of, and we did find a lot of cats, you know, when they're poisoned. They look
simple, very straightforward question to you though, Marion. Are the people who feed feral cats, who think that they're doing something kind and generous for the cat, actually a part of the problem here?
I wouldn't think so, because the problem is so huge. We're never, ever... We have to go back to the square one, as I say, and we have to make somebody responsible, like we are responsible for the domestic dog and the domestic horse. First of all, many of these kittens...
Yeah, but there's individual responsibility for the horse owners and for dog owners.
But there is, but it's bolstered up and it's protected. And I mean, if a horse or a dog, I mean, I know it doesn't work. It works in some counties, it doesn't work at all in other counties. But the legislation is there. But there is nothing, as that lady was saying, you can't prosecute for a cat. Cats are like vermin. You can poison them. You can do what you like with them. And it's unheard of that anybody would ever be prosecuted for what they do to a cat. So cats are kind of fair game, and they're something that live around the place, and people really don't notice them. They're not on the street walking around like you'll see a stray dog.
And something that people may now actually be profiting from removing as a problem. Anya O'Reilly, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
What did you see?
So I just texted in basically back in 2018. My housemate and I, we just noticed there was a feral cat in the area. We were down by North Wall at the time, so along the Lewis line. And my housemate started feeding the cat. I wasn't really too fond of the idea of feeding the cat, but that's what she wanted to do. So we were feeding the cat for a couple of weeks. She was completely feral, so she wasn't really coming around to us, but she was coming every day and she knew the food was there for. And then one day she turned up with her five kittens. So we got in touch with our local cat charity and they kind of just advised us that they'd help us out if we caught them, that they'd help like neuter the kittens as soon as they were old enough to neuter them off.
If you caught them though, being the key thing there, you had to do the hard bit.
Yeah, so the lady at the charity, she provided us with two traps. So there are big, long cages and you just put a bit of food in and it's like a standard trap. Like, and as soon as the cat went in, then the gate slotted behind them. So,
but you didn't get all five in at the same time.
No. It took about two nights of kind of just sit. We just sat in the sitting room. We had like a split level house. So we just sit in the sitting room and we would hear then when they landed on the kind of makeshift roof.
Right.
I'm not really playing the architect very well, but so...
At what point did you turn to your housemate and say, it's because of you that the two of us are sat here now in the middle of the night watching a cat trap out the back window?
We won't get into that. I don't think she listens to Live Lines, but we'll keep it that way.
but there were recriminations, were there, shall we say?
So we caught the five kittens and we caught the mom. There was a very clear father stalking around the place because it was North Wall, like it's around Point Village, around like the Point, so there isn't really many wild animals going around there. It's very built up, but I suppose she trusted us enough to show us the five kittens, or else she kind of knew that it was a food source for them. But there was one, we kind of identified him as the father going around the place, but he never fell for it. I think he was a bit wise to us. He was a bit older as well, so we never quite caught him, so we gave up on him, so he's off. He's probably had millions of kittens since.
And the charity that you gave them to then neutered them at their own expense, did they?
Yes. So they provided us with the traps
Because it could have been quite an expensive enterprise for you, Áine, because I know that there are other charities that look for 25 quid a pop. So, I mean, you could have been looking at 125 quid because your friend had gone and fed a few cats and thought she was doing something nice.
I suppose, it was kind of, my friend was kind of doing the negotiating there. So they said that if we trust them and we were willing to foster them, they did say that they'd help us get them adopted, but that never materialized. So we managed to get them all adopted ourselves. We were very inexperienced and we managed to do it. So it's not.
Okay. Well, what's the lesson? Lesson learned from this, Áine? Is it do not feed feral cats because you're going to end up with months and months of effort of rehoming wild cats and the possible very large vet's bill for getting them neutered?
No. It was a good deed for us to do, and it was very rewarding. Like, because they were little feral kittens, and they all would have been killed on the road at some stage. And they ended up being gorgeous cats. And for about a year or two afterwards, we got updates on the owners. But then it got a bit.
I know, but
we stopped caring.
Think of the birds. Who's thinking of the blue tits and the siskins and the robins and the starlings that are now gracing the back doorsteps of those five homes every night?
Yeah, I'm more of a cat person than a bird person, I'll be honest with you.
Mm. Oh, Áine. Such discrimination. naked bird bigotry on the programme today.
But yeah, no, I'll just say as my statement that it wasn't hard. And our expenses for us anyway in Dublin City Centre were litter and cat food. And that was it. It was really rewarding. They ended up beautiful cats and it was five more house cats as opposed to five more feral cats. And we got the mother, vaccinated. We got the mother neutered, which was, we felt a lot more comfortable about letting her. I accidentally said in my text that we got her rehomed, but we didn't. She was too far gone. So we sent her back out again, but she's not going to have any more.
Well, all's well that ends well there. Five less cats being picked up by the white van cat catchers. 51551 if anybody has had direct dealings with them. Marion, Áine was kind of lucky there that she found a charity that was willing to do the neutering for free.
Yes, she was. Now, we, as I said to your researcher, since the beginning of June, we have always had between 100 and 120 kittens in our sanctuary. That's every day, any day you go down, it'll be between 100 and 130 there. And every one of those, we neuter every single one of them. We neuter the kittens at one kilo. And nothing is homed unless it's neutered and microchipped. But it's a enormous
cost. How big
is
your vet's bill?
Our vet bills, I just have the accounts for last year, are €206,000.
Oh, my God.
The year before, there were 178,000. But we take in a huge number of dogs, hundreds of cats. We have horses. We have goats. We have, the odd wildlife that's on Animal Magic. Our neighbours in Kilmallock are very good to take for us.
But spaying and neutering would be your main vet bill.
Spaying and neutering, I mean, it's huge. Our vet bills, that 206,000 would be, drugs that we would buy separately and vet bills. It would not include any food or any other kennelling or any other cost,
And Cyrilline, would your bills be at the same kind of eye-watering level?
Pardon?
Are your vet bills high, Cyrilline?
Oh, it's extremely high. Our vets are kind. Most of them give us a discount. But yes, we are still looking at very, very substantial bills.
And how much is it to get a cat neutered in the ordinary course of events? I mean, if Áine had not found a charity that was so charitable, is it of the order of 40, 50 quid?
Oh, more a bit around Dublin. A female spay could be €80.
Right, okay.
And we had three female kittens and two boys, so.
God, okay, so it was at least 160.
Yeah.
Or 240, excuse me. God, that is a very, very steep bill, isn't it? So you can see why it is that the guy in the white van disposing of these animals in what sounds like possibly an awful way
is an attractive proposition to anybody who wants to save themselves a very, very substantial vet bill and getting rid of what seems to be an ever-increasing problem. Cyrilline, thank you very much for your call. Marion, you too, and Anya. We'll take a quick break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Bray, County Wicklow, have you tried to drive through it any time recently? It can be an up to 45-minute long endurance test if the traffic is bad. There's a new bridge supposed to go in down near the harbour that's supposed to solve the problem, but it would seem that the new bridge might also have caused another problem as well. Lisa McCauley, good afternoon. How are you?
Hello, Philip. How are you?
What has the bridge got to do with the swan population in the harbour?
Okay, so it's not the bridge we're objecting to. It's the design of the bridge. It's the suspension bridge, which will put all the swans in Bray Harbour at risk of death, basically.
It's a kind of a mini Samuel Beckett-style proposed bridge.
Yeah,
a big cantilevered arch.
Yeah, we have it in Dundrum as well. But unfortunately, the Dargle River is the flight path of these swans. And depending on tides, depending on sun, swans can't see in front of them. They can only see at either side. And before they know it, they've broken their necks, they've died, they're in the water. I work with WRI Rescue, and we get constant calls from the Samuel Beckett Bridge for dead swans, injured swans, and it's all because they can't actually see in front of them. And
do you really? Okay. And they wouldn't be the most agile of birds in the air either. I mean, they're very graceful to look at, but they wouldn't be able to swoop and turn very quickly, would they?
No, they're very large, as you know. So in Bray, all the swans that are there are under the age of 4. They're juveniles. These are ones that will gather together. So they've been evicted from the nest and they have to join a group, which is juveniles. You'll see them in Broadmeadows, you'll see them on the canals. Mm. But basically in Bray, it's a great tourist attraction. Children are there. You can walk among them. They are absolutely fantastic birds. But these birds will be there till they are 4 years of age. So they're young. And in their first year, obviously, they're only learning about life. But as I said, the suspension bridge is what we're objecting to. And the design basically will not work.
Because I've seen them doing this by a bizarre coincidence. I used to live down by the harbour in Bray, and the swans are in the habit of waddling upstream and picking weeds and whatever else there is to eat, and then flying back down to the harbour later on in the day. And that's your fear, that this big cantilevered bridge is going to be smack in the middle of their flight path.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we also have paddle boarders as well, which frighten the life out of the swans. It's no problem. Everyone's entitled to it. But they will take off in a huge flock. And if depend on the tide, they can't get under the bridge, so they will have to try and fly over the bridge. And depend on sunshine, whether it's sunset, sunrise, they just can't see. They just can't see in front of them. They have peripheral vision. So, unfortunately, that will be the problem with the suspension.
Pierce Stokes, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, Philip. How you doing?
It would be an incredibly elegant addition to the Bray skyline and to the Bray road infrastructure, a big cantilevered sort of Santiago Calatrava type affair down there at the harbour, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't think I can agree with that. First of all, thanks a lot for having me on Liveline. It's the second time I've been on talking about wildlife. So thanks to Liveline for giving a voice to the voiceless. In this case, literally mute swans. And the bridge, as Lisa had said there, I think the locals, by and large, don't object to another bridge. We all know, as you said, the transport situation in Bray is really challenging for everybody. And we need to improve the sustainable transport infrastructure, particularly, which a bridge would be. The issue really that we all face is that The environmental impact assessment that was conducted so far didn't actually cover what it needed to cover. And the evidence of that is that on the one site visit that was conducted, they didn't report seeing any swans. So,
which can be a feature because the population does fluctuate throughout the course of the year. It can go absolutely down as low as two or three or four birds and up to 120.
That's exactly right. So the feasibility was done in January, where obviously the swan population was much lower. But at peak times, you're going to see about 120, maybe even 150 swans. So the concern there is that we need a new environmental impact assessment so that we can check this out, and one that takes into consideration the style. Now, you mentioned there that it's quite an elegant bridge. I don't know that it's in keeping with the local landscape. Bray Harbour is a beautiful traditional destination almost for a lot of people. And I don't think a giant white bridge would amount to a vanity project, as far as I can tell, slapped into the middle of what is otherwise a really nice, almost quaint area of Bray. I think it's misjudged at best. And I just want to say also that on Sunday, we're going to be having a little bit of a kind of a protest and a photo shoot. The ballet dancer Monica Lockman is going to bring her students down dressed as swans. So anybody who's interested in making sure that the council listen to the locals should come down at 1 o'clock on Sunday to Bray Harbour to the swan sanctuary.
I tell you, I have a big problem believing that an environmental impact assessment wouldn't have taken note of the swans, because these things are hundreds of pages long and go into the most minute detail. And are you telling me that in all of those pages and all of that detail, they didn't take account of the thing that Bray Harbour is most famous for?
What they've done is, in the desktop research, they account for swans, but in the site visit, they didn't record swans. So I don't think one day is enough of a visit, basically. I think you need a visit at least every season to see what other impacts might be having. So the impact assessment does acknowledge swans. It also acknowledges that foxes, pygmy shrews, stoats, very important and protected Irish wildlife, will be affected. And the other shortcoming that I believe the environmental impact assessment has is that they say that, you know, we're going to look at what the impacts are going to be for the 2 years that the bridge is being constructed. And then the ongoing impacts they identify as vibrations from additional traffic. But they don't take into consideration this suspension bridge style and what it's going to have by being in the flight path of 120 swans.
Okay, well, let me
I give some context on that?
Well, just second, though, because let me just be the big, nasty, devil's advocate, Daddy Warbucks, capitalist character here, saying, about the pygmy shrews now, Pierce Stokes, whatever about the foxes, the 30, 35,000 people living in Bray, living in gridlock at certain times of the day, are crying out for this bridge. They need that traffic that's trying to get down to the Dart station taken away from the main road.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And what I wanted to say about that was, Lisa and myself and various other volunteers who are objecting to this are regularly called down to the Samuel Beckett Bridge or even down to the Dart line in Bray to get injured swans off the tracks or off the road. And what I think is going to happen is that we're going to build this bridge in order to alleviate traffic. And the style of the bridge, the aesthetics of the bridge, are actually going to end up causing more traffic problems. You're talking about a hell of a lot more injured swans landing on the train tracks down there. So that's going to delay the darts. It's going to delay everything coming up from Wexford. That's a problem. And we already go out and move them. So that's going to be
worse. And how often does that happen, Pierce?
Well, Samuel Beckett Bridge, I think, injures a swan once a month, it would feel like. There's, you know, that kind of care. Okay. But that's only what...
And how often do they fly onto the Dart line? I mean, I've heard leaves on the tracks announcements. I've never heard a swans on the track announcement.
Yeah, I mean, often. I don't know the exact numbers. And Aaron Rodair, and they've got a good team of people there at Bray Dart Station that are kind of capable of moving the swans on. But we don't hear about all of these. We just, you know, like Lisa said, Wildlife Rehabilitation Ireland, they get a call in occasionally, but there's
We'll put a call through to Irish Rail and see if that is as big a problem as you seem to think it is. Let me bring in Marcia Nicholson here. Marcia, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Philip. Thanks for having us on.
You're living in Bray as well, are you?
I am Bray resident for the past, I won't mention how many years, a long time.
Well, what is the traffic like now?
The traffic in Bray is, it's gridlock. I can't get out of my house some days. And I think, can you hear me okay,
Absolutely,
Philip?
Absolutely, perfectly, yeah.
Yeah. What Pierce said there, I may correct, I'm not 100% sure. This new road that will lead, it's the Link Road, that will lead to the bridge that both Pierce and Lisa mentioned, that road is only for buses, pedestrians and cyclists. So it's a fallacy to say that it's going to alleviate any traffic in Bray. And that road is going straight over what is currently the floodplain. So that's another, I'm working with the floodplain people too. I think Pierce and Lisa have covered a lot about the swans and the bridge and the impact a suspension bridge will have on the colony. But the road, a lot of people seem to think, is going to take the traffic from Castle Street. And this isn't true, because it's only buses. And so the buses will still continue on their normal route and they'll swing left at the main bridge into Bray. So we'll still have traffic on Castle Street, plus the buildings that they're talking about building on the whole floodplain.
Okay, but you would have traffic minus the buses, which you'd probably mean you'd be able to take
them. Buses will still travel on Castle Street, you know, when you come into Bray, up to the main bridge in Bray. The buses will still be there on that road.
So is this
only
an argument?
There they'll swing left down onto what is this Link Road that is going to be going over the flood.
All right. And is this an argument then in your mind, Marcia, for not having a bridge at all or just not having a cantilevered bridge?
My main concern is the swans. I have been rescuing swans in Bray Harbour for 15 years. And as Pierce said there, I would often be up the Dart Line taking swans in from collisions.
How often, Marcia?
It depends. I don't like to lay blame, but Lisa brought the subject up there. If there are, because Bray is so busy, and if paddle boarders go up, there may have been three or four in a row over, it was St. Patrick's weekend this year.
Okay, so when you say go up, you mean paddle up the Dargle River?
They go
from
up,
the harbour.
Yeah, and so if they, of course, they love the swans, and the swans are so tame in the harbour, you think you can paddle over to them and say hello. But the swans are terrified, and so they take flight. I have photographic documentation, also where one flew very low over the existing bridge into Bray, a few feet away from a bus. But that was directly related to just being frightened on the river.
These are wild animals.
These
Stay
are wild
away
animals.
Unless they choose to come up to you.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, a situation like that, a suspension bridge in place, 5-10 swans taking flight down the river in a panic, boom.
And look, there's not an engineer among us, or is there? Have either of you, any of the three of you, got engineering experience? Like, I mean, I'm wondering why, if there is an existing bridge there that isn't cantilevered, can you not just have a bridge that'll go over that 30 metre or whatever it is span of river without having to have this big cantilevered structure?
Of course. And also there have been some comments on the Bray Open Forum, various other places where engineers have come in and said there's absolutely no need for the span of the river. There's absolutely no need for that type of bridge, that height of bridge, the span that the bridge will actually be over the river.
I suspect, though, that that boatyard is going to be developed for apartments as well, that the idea might be to gentrify the entire area, perhaps?
Precisely, yeah. So right. The existing people in Bray are facing floods in Dargle up the Little Bray area, if you're familiar with it.
This is where the existing golf course is now.
If that is built on.
Certain times of year that was always underwater, wasn't it? Let me bring in Eddie here, 51551 for your text. Eddie, good afternoon. What was the point you wanted to make?
A very simple point. I was out there in Bray and I wanted to go down to the harbour area, down to the beach kind of area. And I walked down the side of the river. An absolutely superb development there by the council. Probably the same people who are going to build a bridge, but why did they get that right? Lovely places to sit down. I saw a few egrets there, which would be a white heron for those people who might know. A lovely little bird. And I stopped a man and I said to him, look, when I go down further, can I cross over to get the train back to Dublin or out to Greystones? You can. And he says, and sure, have a look at the swans when you're down there. And I was crossing the footbridge, and when I looked over it, it was absolutely stunning. They were kind of restricted in a way by the tide had gone out, and they couldn't get up to the upper Dargle, or rather the Dargle into Bray. But I was privileged then to see them kind of going around in circles and going in a straight line. And then when I came over another bit, there was loads of families there with children, and the children feeding the swans. Now, maybe they shouldn't have been doing that, but the point was, it was a very family-orientated thing. And when I contrasted that whole area there, I said, Jesus, this is lovely. And compare it with what happened in Greystones, where they built an absolutely unbelievable number of apartments. And from my perspective, okay, maybe it had to be done, but God, I'd hate to see that kind of more historical landscape in Bray Harbour going the same route. And somebody mentioned there something about apartments, so I'd say all that's in there and building the bridge and justifying extra accommodation, that kind of thing. So my basic point is,
justifying extra accommodation. I mean, Eddie, housing crisis. We need homes.
Yeah, of course, you need homes.
And we need homes beside public transport nodes. You know, we've got to be building on these brownfield sites if we're to accommodate everybody.
Of course, you have. But you've got to see the bigger picture as well. That we're in the middle of a climate thing and an environmental thing. So if you take 120 swans there, and to my mind, they are making a massive contribution to the whole enjoyment of the area there. And I said to some of the young people there with their little boats, how are you going to get out there now with the swans? And they said, oh, when we put our boats down there, the swans will move aside. And we're all happily coexisting. But I suppose the basic point is, build a bridge. That's fine. There's a lovely bridge there, lovely granite capstones on it. And I have no idea why they want to build a cantilever bridge. And is it just because that's the way you do it now, and like in Dundrum and like the Sam Beckett Bridge and all the rest of it? But there, somebody said there, the environmental impact statement, I don't know who is asleep at the wheel, but if you can't see that 120 swans have some kind of rights, at least the right to stay alive. That's my basic point. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
All right.
And I've no extra grind. I don't live in Bray.
It is an attraction that brings people to Bray, more than the Bray Air Show, more than Brayhead, more than any of the pubs along the seafront. The swans do seem to bring people in their hundreds into the town. You could not, I'm sure the chambers of commerce of every other town in the country is probably jealous of what Bray has naturally there. It's obviously, judging by the calls that are coming in to us, something that people feel very strongly about trying to hold on to. Eddie, thank you very much for your call.
Not a bother. It's just a simple point. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'd hate to see it going the way of Greystones. I think that the massive mistakes made there. You know yourself, Phil Bob talked.
Lisa and Marcia and Pierce as well, thank you very much, and to you too, Eddie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Elizabeth, hello, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Philip, and thank you very much for having me on.
Well, thank you very much for making the call. You made a call to about something that we heard the president of NUIG, Kieran O'Hogarty, talking about during the course of the week. In the abstract, but your son is very much living the experience of being discriminated against now because of grade inflation in the Leaving Cert.
Yes, absolutely. My son did his Leaving Cert prior to 2019. So this year he was competing on the CAO using his Leaving Cert results. But the Leaving Cert results this year were really inflated because the students were given the option of both sitting the Leaving Cert exams, which were in a way simplified, but also using predictive grades and taking the better of those two options. So what you have this year is students with really, really high points. And my son was competing against them using his original Leaving Cert results. And as you say, and the chair of the CAO himself said that this student, and there's about 10,000 of them, not just my son, all affected by this great inflation.
And it's very substantial, because they were talking about if you did your leaving cert in 2020, you would have gotten a 7% bump. This year, you would have got an additional 4% bump. So yes, your son and the other 9,999 of them who did their leaving cert before now, who are trying to get college places, are really quite seriously disadvantaged.
They are. And actually, the grade inflation at the higher grades where my son would have been competing is even in excess of the figures that you've just given.
Indeed,
so
yeah.
In previous years, there might have been 6.2% got H1s in maths, and this year, over 18% got H1s in maths. So previous students using their old results, original results, couldn't compete. They were at an automatic disadvantage.
Right. And what does he want to do, and what did he get in 2017?
Okay. He wanted to do medicine. He did the HPAT the year he did his leaving cert and didn't do well enough in the HPAT to get medicine, and then repeated the HPAT the following year and didn't do well enough again. So this year, he went to college for 2 years, wasn't happy in his course, really wanted medicine, studied again this year for the HPAT, did very well in it. In any other year, he would have gotten medicine this year.
Uh-huh.
He would have had his choice of medicine courses. And this year, because of grade inflation, he has been absolutely ruled out of the race.
Right. And he had the points in 2017 to do it. He just
he would
didn't
have had
do well.
The points. He didn't have the HPAT results in 2017.
Okay. But he would have had the points.
He would have had the HPAT results this year had there been no grade inflation. He would have been in medicine.
That's very, very cruel, isn't it?
Yes. And I mean, I think it's very important, Philip, to realise that he's not alone. I'm sure there's many other kids. And I know other kids are disappointed with the CAO results, perhaps, or the results today that they're after getting their courses they've been offered. But the difference is that students from this year were all competing on a level playing field. Everyone was inflated. So the rising tide of points brought everyone up. But the students from previous years weren't in that boat. They were left to sink.
Yeah. And the hope was that with the additional, 4,290 places, I think, that they were talking about, that people in your son's position were going to be able to be accommodated.
No, because they couldn't be, because the students with the higher points, a large number of them, it wasn't a small number of students with high points, a large number of students with higher points snapped up all those places. It's not that I expect students from previous years to be advantaged. I just think they should have been compensated for the grade inflation to allow them to compete equally.
Yeah, I mean, it isn't that hard to do after all,
no,
really, is it?
No, it's a statistical sum that the State Examinations Commission, in giving the results over to the CAO, could have made that provision.
Just lob on a few extra points there. So what's he going to do, Elizabeth?
I don't know. We're sitting back and thinking.
Is he going to continue with the course that he's not happy with?
Next year, there's going to be a cohort of students from this year going in competing in the CAO again next year. So in effect, next year's Leaving Cert students are going to be disadvantaged as well.
Yeah, they are indeed. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
It's a very big issue. And to be honest, it's one that I have been raising. I have contacted Minister Harris and Minister Foley over the summer on a number of occasions to ask them, could this be taken into consideration? Because I could see there was going to be a knock-on effect. There was great inflation last year, and everyone was saying it's going to be higher this year, which it ended up being. And I don't believe that Minister Foley, the State Exams Commission, took any account of this problem.
And sure, by the time the next year of Leaving Cert results and CAO offers rolls around, sure, he could have done an entire college degree in those 3 years.
Yes, I know. I just feel sorry for any student like my son who's in this position today, who is being discriminated against, really.
And as you say, 10,000 of them. How is he taking it, Elizabeth?
Oh, he's very disappointed. I mean, he's hardly able to talk about it. I mean, we're going to just sit back now for the week and think what to do.
All right. Look, the very best to him.
Thanks, Philip, for taking the time to listen.
Okay. Take care, Elizabeth.
Thank you
very much for your call. Bye-bye.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
If you were listening to the people who called the programme yesterday, there is absolutely no way that you would have failed to have been impressed by their bravery and their insight and just their absolute brilliance and their articulate way in which they told their story about not having done the breast checks that they needed to do because they were in their 20s and 30s and thought that this was an older person's condition, and thankfully, obviously, lived lived to tell the tale. But let me just give you a number that I came across after it came off air yesterday. In 2019, before the pandemic, there was 170,000 women who went and got their breasts checked through the Breast Check screening service. Now, that's obviously just for people between the ages of 50 and 69 who are healthy. But that's 170,000 people. 56,000 went last year in 2020. Over 110,000, 114,000 women didn't get checked last year. And Breast Check would tell you that of every 1,000 women who come in who are healthy, who've no reason to suspect that there's anything wrong with them at all, go in to get their breasts checked, that for every 1,000 of them in that situation between the ages of 50 and 69, 6 cancers are picked up. So that means that there are, at the moment, possibly up to 700 women who have breast cancer right now who don't know it because they didn't go, because of the pandemic, and get their breasts checked last year. And Catherine, good afternoon to you. How are you?
Hi, Philip.
Listening yesterday, you started to get the feeling that breast cancer screening is another kind of cervical check debacle in the making.
Well, that's my fear, and I fear the fallout may be even bigger.
Why?
Because so many people are awaiting screening, including myself. And when I contacted Breast Check, because I hadn't been called for my July screening, I was told that the earliest possible screening that I will get is September 2022.
Wow. Okay, so that would then put you in, what, 3 years since you had last had...
No, it was due this year, so that'll put me 14 months after my scheduled screening.
Okay, but it's 2 years since you've had one previously, is it?
Yes.
So you're going to over 3 years before you would get your next appointment?
That's right. That's
now, I don't want to cause alarm because 3 years is the standard wait in the UK that their clinicians, for whatever reason, have decided differently from ours, that you can afford to wait that long and that it'll catch as many cancers. But still, you must be a bit worried.
I'm seriously concerned. I've previously had an abnormal screening, and my way of knowing that I am staying well is to have my 2 yearly screening.
Okay.
Also, I work as a healthcare professional, and I am concerned for all the other women out there who have delayed screening, and all of those who will have a delayed diagnosis, who maybe instead of needing a lumpectomy and maybe some local radiation, may now need radical mastectomy, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, or have even a worse prognosis.
Indeed. Because...
And what concerned me, Philip, was when I contacted the Breast Check offices in Cork and got this answer, I asked to speak with somebody to make a complaint about this. And when that lady rang me back, she was very cordial and helpful. But I asked her what their plans were, or what they planned to put in place to remediate this situation. And I was told that due to a lack of resources, there wasn't any plan to increase or escalate their screening to catch up with the backlog.
Yeah, that had been the position, the last position that I saw officially coming out of the HSE back in February was, we know we're not going to catch up on the backlog, so we just have to take it that there are going to be people now who, as standard, over the next couple of years, are going to be checked once every 3 years rather than every two.
Well, I just don't think that's good enough. I just think these... You know, this is people's health, this is people's lives we're dealing with here. And I think, you know, we've shown as a nation and as a group of healthcare workers how we can put our shoulder to the wheel when it's necessary.
And what area of the health service are you working in? Have you had to play that catch-up game, Catherine?
I have. I work in general practice, and I would do cervical screening as part of the cervical check programme. And in order to catch up with the backlog of overdue smear tests that occurred during the pause in the screening, I scheduled extra screening, and I have told the reception staff at the practice not to turn away any woman who requests screening.
Fair play, fair play. So how many extra hours were you working a week in order to clear that backlog?
Well, I was actually more boxing clever with how I arranged my appointments. So I don't want to come across as, you know, doing more, but I just tried harder to prioritise those appointments.
And you were able to get rid of the backlog? There was nobody
yes.
who was sitting on a waiting list, as it were?
No, I have no waiting list now. I've cleared my backlog. I've cleared my waiting list.
Is it open to everybody to do that?
Well, I don't work in Breast Check, but, you know, as I said, we've seen what all healthcare workers in Ireland have done during the pandemic. I've put my shoulder to the wheel. I know other practice nurses who've done the same. We all have the same resources. None of us have extra resources. So I just don't accept that it's good enough to say, well, we're going to have a 14-month backlog and that there's nothing we can do about
it. See, I think they were also talking about a critical staff shortage at the skilled end of the process in Breast Check. They're pointing out that it takes 15 years to train a breast radiologist, 7 years to train a radiographer, and that these people couldn't just be plucked off trees and put into clinics just like that.
I understand that. I absolutely do. But at the same time, we can't simply wring our hands and do nothing.
I know. Well, it's absolutely terrifying to think now that if there are 114,000 people, and that was a very conservative estimate because they said that they had hoped that they were going to be examining more people. They hoped that they were going to be examining up to 128,000 people last year, but they didn't get to them. That you're talking up to 800 women right now who have no reason to believe that there's anything wrong with them, but had they gone and had a breast mammogram with Breast Check, 6 in every 1,000 of them would have come back with a positive result.
Exactly. And I meet these people in the practice, and I've had friends and colleagues who have had diagnoses, and some of them through Breast Check, an early diagnosis that has literally saved their lives.
It's very scary, isn't it?
It is very scary. And I just feel that, you know, we have to do something about it. I'm powerless to do it. I'm coming on here to represent myself and the other women who are asking me the hard questions that I can't answer for them.
Well, in the first course, anybody can go to their GP, anybody who suspects that there is anything wrong. And God, I started reading through the list of things that are indicators for possible breast cancer. And I think rather than read through the list, it's safest to say that if there is even the most minute change in your skin colour, pigmentation, tissue, hardness, softness, pain, dimpling, lumps, whatever, anything should be checked out immediately by your GP. Don't wait.
Absolutely.
Stay on the line there, Catherine. Dara, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good, Phil. I'm good.
And unlikely as it might sound, you have every reason to be joining in the conversation now about breast cancer survival.
Yes, yes. I was that soldier.
What happened, Dara? When did you get this diagnosis?
The beginning of the year, early January, I came in from a run on a Saturday and I had a shower. And during the course of the shower, I noticed there was a lump on my breast that wasn't there before. And I dried myself off and I forgot all about it, Philip, because there was absolutely no pain.
Mm-hmm.
So the next morning,
Dara, can I interrupt you for 1 second? I beg your pardon for diverting you from your story, but just describe that lump in as much detail as you possibly can, will you?
Okay. It was about the size of and the diameter of the top of my thumbnail. It was a substantial lump.
Uh-huh.
Now, it wasn't protruding through the skin. It was inside. It was to the right of my right nipple, but it was in deep. But
and was it squishy? Was it hard?
No, it was hard. It was hard.
And did it hurt at all when you pressed against it?
Absolutely not. Nothing. No.
Okay. All right. Sorry. So anyway, you ignored it like all good men do. Of course you ignored it.
Well, I ignored it because by the time I dried myself off and dressed myself, I went downstairs. One of my kids was calling me. I went downstairs. I'd forgotten all about it, Philip, because there was no pain.
Okay.
So, but every time I went to have a shower, I could feel it. So I think I let it go for about 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, there's something wrong here. So I went to my GP in Drogheda, Dr. Oliver Lynn, and he had a look at it, and he said, there's something going on. I said, it could be a cyst. But he did a scan. A couple of days later, I was back in. He did a scan, sent it up to Dublin. And about a week or so later, I was called up to Professor Morris Stokes' clinic in Eccles Street. So I went up. He told me he saw the scan. He'd like to further investigate, and I was to go for a biopsy. So towards the end of, no, I think it was the next week, I went over, I was in the matter. I had a biopsy. I had a mammogram, which was an experience in itself. And, I mean, at this stage, breast cancer was not on my agenda.
Well, of course it wasn't. I mean, at what point did you turn around to any of these guys and say, oh, would you go away? I'm as likely to have breast cancer as my wife is to have testicular cancer.
When the results of the biopsy came back, I was back in the breast in Professor Stokes' clinic, and he told me I had breast cancer. And
did you have trouble processing that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was looking around for cameras. I was on camera.
Oh, God.
Because I haven't got a breast, and unless he failed to recognise I'm a man, so this is...
Yes, back to medical school with you, Doctor. There's a few anatomical basics that you're overlooking here.
I actually need a new doctor, I thought. This fella's away in the head.
Yeah.
So he told me I'd breast cancer, and I asked him, what are we going to do? I said, I pulled him into this as well. I said, what are we going to do? So he said, it has to come off. I said, what has to come off? He says, breast, and I have to take your breast and your nipple. And I turned around.
And I presume it's called a mastectomy in a man's case as well, is it?
Oh, it is. Yes. Yeah, it's exactly the same procedure. It's not. It's the breast tissue.
Okay.
You take out.
And at any point did you stop him and say, "Hang on a second, how did this happen? I'm a man."
I did later on at subsequent meetings with him after the mastectomy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was on a roller coaster, Philip, and I was in a woman's world. I went into his waiting room, and I was the only man there. From it was about 5, 6, 7 people when I'd go in. I was the only man, and I felt very uncomfortable because I was getting peculiar looks. And as new patients would come into the waiting room, nobody would sit beside me.
Yeah.
They were all, and I know now because I put a lot of thought into breast cancer and for women and how what they're going through and how they feel. And I know now that they were probably wondering, what in the name of God is this man doing here?
Indeed. And you know something? One of the things that came across yesterday's programme was, if there is one small silver lining in the experience that breast cancer survivors went through, is the camaraderie that those women extend to each other and the big warm embrace and hug that they're able to give each other by way of support. I can't imagine that was there for you.
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. I felt every time I went in, I felt uneasy because everybody else felt uneasy.
Yeah, you were an interloper in their world. What
Absolutely,
the hell are you doing here?
Yes. Sorry, go on.
No. Sorry, please, I interrupted you.
As it went on, okay, I used to have to go, after the mastectomy, I had to go in back to the clinic every Friday for 6, 7, 8 weeks. Because there's a pocket left when they take the breast tissue out, which keeps filling up.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go in every Friday to get it drained. And every Friday, it was the same thing. Every Friday, I'd go in, I'd sit down, and no one would sit beside me. No one would even look at me.
Right.
You know, and but at that stage, because I started to put a lot of thought into it after the mastectomy, I knew why. I knew it was because I was in their world. And like me, the vast majority of people, males, and breast cancer, they're just not in the same sense.
Well, of course, I mean, look, you didn't feel like you belonged there, so of course they wouldn't feel like you belonged there either. But how did you, or did you explain it to everybody else at the time? Did you specify that it was breast cancer that you had, if you told anybody, or you just say, I have a bit of a cancer issue and I'm getting treatment?
I told people I had breast cancer. The vast majority of them were like me, they were shocked. How can you have breast cancer?
Yeah, I know, but it's exhausting when you have to explain any kind of illness, and then you have to deal with the, you know, the additional, how the hell did that happen, Dara? Because there must have been 10 times the number of questions for you than there would have been for anybody else.
Yeah, I had loads of questions, and I remember I asked Prof Stokes, I asked him about how have I got breast cancer? Now, he was explaining to me that 1 in 1,000 men, he said, it is rare, he said, but 1 in 1,000 men get breast cancer. And you're one of those men.
Well, when you put it like that, it doesn't sound that rare, 1 in 1,000.
It doesn't, but...
And the actual mastectomy then... How did that leave you feeling? I mean, was it painful for a start?
No, the most painful thing I did was the mammogram, because it's a device that's for all the world, it's like a sandwich maker. You lift it up, you're supposed to, you put your breast in it, and they close, they squeeze the lid back down. But when you haven't got a breast, that's very, very difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I was manoeuvred around and whatever, and so that was the most uncomfortable. Obviously, when I had the mastectomy, I woke up after it in the hospital. First reaction was I put my hand up to my chest, but it was bandaged up and did nothing. But hasn't pain wise? No, I had the mastectomy on a Thursday, Philip, and I got out of hospital. I got out on Saturday.
All right. You're obviously a fit enough man if you're out running when you first noticed this.
I would be fairly fit, yeah.
Okay. Did it change your body shape? Did it change your body image and your idea of yourself?
No, it didn't. It didn't. But what it changed was my whole outlook on breast cancer and how it affects, how psychologically it must affect women.
Yeah. You have an insight now that not very many men do.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, look, I've a very nasty looking, scars. I've no right nipple, but I don't need a nipple. It's not part of who I am. So it doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me, but I can see, I could imagine if I was a girl, if I was a woman, it must be devastating, absolutely devastating.
Well, if you were a younger man as well, thinking about, you know, going away on holidays with all the friends, you wouldn't be comfortable sitting around a swimming pool any longer. I mean, you're at a stage of life, I assume, that you're not flexing your muscles by the poolside and trying to impress your lady friends, are you?
I shouldn't be anyway.
But... Did it impact you in that way, though? I mean, did it impact your sense of self and your psychological balance?
No, in no way. Now, in no way at all. Because a lot of people are talking about now, at no time I would get uncomfortable. I was very, very uncomfortable any time I had to go into the waiting room to sit with the other patients, who were all female. But very early on, I understood. understood where they were coming from very, very early on.
Okay.
So I just went through with it. I knew what to expect when I went into that waiting room, and I was never waiting that long, really, 20 minutes, half an hour, and I'd be called in. And
right. And Dara, look, let's just do the public service bit here for other men. How much more at risk were you because of your age, being over 50?
I really don't know the answer to that. That's the question, Philip. I don't know. But apparently, yeah, the older you get, the more likely it is that you will develop breast cancer. But then again, I mean, for a male, it's just not... It's not on our radar whatsoever.
I know. But look, we should all be having a good old poke and a prod
and a
rummage all around. And now you have license. Here you go. We're giving you carte blanche to do whatever it is that you want to yourself over the objections of your spouse in the shower, in the privacy of your shower. Because if you hadn't spotted that, Dara, my God.
Well, I tell you what, Philip, it will be impossible not to when you're showering. It would be impossible not to. And the first thing I thought of with breast cancer after, I was in the hospital bed after the mastectomy, and I was thinking to myself, if I had a breast, I never would have found that because I just felt the lump. But if I was a woman, you wouldn't feel the lump.
Okay.
Unless you really went looking for it. Now, I wasn't looking for it, but you couldn't miss it.
That's very interesting. Okay. So, lucky you found it, but lucky that you were a man as well. Dara?
Yes, yeah.
Fair play. Thank you very much for the call. It's illuminating in the best way possible. Because I tell you, it wasn't something that I'd ever thought about before. And large sums of money that the vast majority of men listening now won't have thought about it in the same way either. So thank you very much for your call.
No, I would just like to say one thing, Philip. I'm now an ambassador for Breast Cancer Ireland. And I'm taking part in the Great Pink Run, which is starting in October. And everybody out there, I'd like everybody to get involved. Go on to Breast Cancer Ireland's website, because all funds raised go into the investigations of what breast cancer is, how it, you know, it's going to help. It's going to bring awareness.
Yeah. And the good news here is the survival rates when this is detected early, if you're doing your poking and your prodding in the shower, there's 85, 90, 95% 5-year survival rates if you catch this at the right point in time. It is a survivable condition.
Absolutely, absolutely. I asked Prof Stokes after about my 6th or 7th week come back into him. I said, Prof, what would have happened if I didn't come in when I came in? And he said to me, Dara, best case scenario is chemotherapy. That's the best case.
And let's not even contemplate the worst case now. Dara, thank you so much for your call. You're very good to take that take the time for us this afternoon. Good luck to you.
Not at all. Cheerio.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Catherine Dunn, good afternoon. How much have you spent having wild cats snipped or spayed?
Approximately 1,600.
On how many cats is that?
Well, I wouldn't have a clue. One had a leg amputated, so that would be in the cost to that. And one or two would have had visits to the vet for eye infections.
I be really, really crude in the 30 seconds that we have left to us? It would have been much cheaper for you to have them euthanized.
Oh, well, you see, I can't. You're either that type or you're not.
You're a bit of a softie, are you?
Yeah. But my main point is tell people, even if they have their own cats, none of them are my cats, they're all feral cats. And there's Elaine and Anne go around collecting them with traps. They spend every weekend helping out. And I'd say to people, have their male cats, even if they're their own cats, neutered, because they go off and impregnate other cats.
Have them neutered, have them spayed.
Have the males done, because they don't have the kittens.
Keep them in to look after the birds. All right, Catherine, thank you very much. Cheers. Today's programme was produced by Fergus Sweeney, researched by Richie Byrne. Sound Liam Mullen, BCO, was Daniel Keating. Joe's going to be back with you tomorrow. Ray Darcy on the way next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with a Kia e-Niro. Going electric? Stop wondering and start driving. The Kia e-Niro with a range up to 455 kilometres.
1850 715 815. Stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.